Chuck Gregg, we always keep up with some of the writers and bloggers at the Secular Outpost. They talk about your work quite often and reference your work. And does theism explain the necessity of moral truths? Talks about your moral argument and says that it fails. What is your take from why there'd be a bug, as Jeff says in this article, and not a feature in your moral argument for God's existence?
The argument he gives is a rather complex argument for thinking that the existence of God would not suffice to explain necessary moral truths. Okay. He seems to want to defend a kind of atheistic moral Platonism, though that's not entirely clear.
Okay. Is it theism expresses a necessary proposition, and that itself is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for God's existence to explain necessary truths, including necessary truths about the existence of moral values?
Yes, here I think he's not expressed himself very well. We shouldn't say theism expresses a necessary proposition. I'm not even sure what that means. What the theist wants to say is that the sentence, God exists, expresses a necessary proposition. The sentence, God exists, expresses a necessary proposition. Now, that sentence does not itself express a necessary proposition, because if the English language never existed, for example, then it would not be true that the sentence, God exists, expresses a necessary proposition. That's a contingent feature of the fact that English exists. But I do think that the proposition expressed by the sentence, God exists, is a necessary truth. And then I do think that the existence of God does serve to explain the existence of necessary moral values and other moral truths.
As software engineers might say, this is a bug, not a feature, in Craig's moral argument for God's existence.
Now, I take it by that he means this is some sort of a defect in the moral argument, mm-hmm. I guess. Go ahead.
Yeah. If Craig's moral argument requires that theism be a necessary proposition, then it is much more likely that theism is necessarily false.
Yeah, now I don't understand why he thinks that that would be the case. I think the moral argument does lead to the necessary truth of the proposition God exists. But I see that as an entailment or implication of the argument, not as a defect. So the question is, why does he think that's problematic?
Paul Draper explains the point. Suppose that theism is not a contingent proposition. Then it is much more likely that it is necessarily false than that it is necessarily true.
Okay, now that's odd. So let's assume that the proposition God exists is either necessarily true or impossible. Jeff thinks it's much more likely that this is an impossible proposition than a necessarily true one. Now, why does he think that?
He said this is made clear by any objective comparison of the available reasons for thinking that theism is necessarily true to the available reasons for thinking that it is necessarily false.
Now, that seems to me to confuse the epistemology with ontology. The reasons for thinking that theism is necessarily true has nothing to do with the necessity of the proposition that God exists. That would only have to do with whether or not we have warrant mm-hmm. for believing that proposition. But that seems to me to be completely irrelevant to the necessary truth of that proposition. Similarly, the reasons that he gives for thinking that this proposition is impossible are the old coherence of theism objections, that it's improbable that there should be a being which is omnipotent, omniscient, and morally perfect. And you can't just assert that. You've got to argue that. And I don't think any of those sorts of objections go through. There's been an enormous amount of ink spilled over the question of the coherence of theism. And I don't think anybody has even come close to demonstrating that the concept of God is a logically incoherent concept. So I don't think we've seen any reasons given here by Jeff for thinking that the proposition God exists is probably impossible. To give a non-theological example, take the mathematical proposition called Goldbach's conjecture. Nobody knows whether Goldbach's conjecture is true or false. But if it's true, it's necessarily true. If it's false, it's necessarily false. Now, the fact that we have no good reason to believe Goldbach's conjecture doesn't do anything at all to undermine the fact that this could well be a necessarily true proposition. So these epistemic considerations are simply irrelevant to the necessary truth of the proposition in question.
He said, well, let's put that to the side and assume that God's existence really is broadly logically necessary.
Now, that's a funny thing to do. I mean, if you put it to the side and you assume that God's existence really is necessary, well, then that's the end of the debate, right? Who needs a moral argument for God's existence? If you assume it, that God's existence is broadly logically necessary. I think that what Jeff has done here is he's thinking that it's an assumption of the moral argument that God exists necessarily, which would threaten to make it circular, when it is actually an entailment of the moral argument. It's an implication of the moral argument. In fact, the moral argument, as I stated, doesn't really imply the necessary truth of God's existence. The argument, as I run it, is that if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. Three, therefore, God exists. Now, that doesn't say anything about the necessity of the conclusion. That only arises when we reflect on the fact that objective moral values and duties themselves don't seem to be contingent. It seems to be true in every possible world that torturing a child for fun is morally wrong. So that would be then an implication of the moral argument, that it leads us not to a contingently existing God, but it in fact leads us to a God whose existence is metaphysically necessary. So that's an entailment, not an assumption of the moral argument.
Well, he continues, if that were so, how would it follow that God's necessary existence somehow explains the necessary existence of objective moral values?
And I think that people like Robert Adams, Philip Quinn, William Alston have done a good job on this question. They argue that God himself is the paradigm of moral goodness, and that his commandments are the source of our moral obligations. And insofar as we human beings resemble God's nature, we too have intrinsic moral value and goodness. So I do think that there's explanatory depth in theism. Now, his response is to react to my argument against the alternative of atheistic moral Platonism, which is the view that moral values exist as abstract objects. Now, this connects, interestingly, Kevin, with my work on divine aseity, doesn't it?
It does.
Because in talking about the challenge of Platonism to divine aseity, we talk about the existence of abstract objects like mathematical objects, numbers, sets, and functions, or possible worlds, propositions, properties, and so forth. But we could also talk about moral values. If the Platonist thinks that moral values are abstract objects, then this provides an atheistic alternative, but only at the expense, I think, of a very extravagant metaphysic. Namely, you're positing this realm of abstract moral objects, presumably existing beyond space and time. And that raises a whole host of metaphysical questions, one of which is the one that he responds to here. I find it hard even to comprehend the Platonist view. As I say here, I understand what it means to say a person is just or that he acts justly, but I draw a complete blank when we're told that justice just exists as an abstract moral value. And this is all the more obvious when you reflect that the abstract object, justice, is no more just than quickness is quick, or being five-fingered is five-fingered, or redness is red, or wisdom is wise. These are not properties that these abstract objects have. So if justice itself is not just, and there are no human beings and no God, then how is it that justice exists? This is almost trembling on the brink of self-contradiction. So I have a very difficult time, I mean, speaking just honestly, in even understanding Platonism.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the beef is here, Bill, because he says your selection of justice as an example of a moral value is odd.
Yeah, he wants to argue that justice is not a value concept, that it's a duty concept. Well, we could quibble about that, but then he says, well, fortunately, Craig does give other examples. Mercy, love, forbearance. You know, how does forbearance exist as an abstract object, Kevin? I don't even understand what that means. I know what it means for a person to forbear with someone else, but when the Platonist says forbearance exists as an abstract object, I just have a complete blank.
The article continues, here I want to use moral values like mercy or love to show that God's necessary existence is not a sufficient condition for explaining the necessary existence of moral values.
Now, wait a minute, Kevin. I thought he was supposed to be defending atheistic moral Platonism. And I don't see that he's defended it against my objection that it's unintelligible. Does Jeff really think that love is an abstract object that exists beyond space and time independently of any persons? He's not responding to the objection that atheistic moral Platonism is unintelligible. Instead, he's trying to turn the tables now and say, well, you theists don't explain the necessity of moral values because God's existence won't explain the necessary existence of things like mercy and love.
Okay. It says, if moral values like mercy or love exist as properties of persons, not as mere abstractions, it would seem that they are relational and so would require that two or more persons exist.
And I agree with that. And that, if you look at my chapter on the Trinity in Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, that's one of the plausibility arguments that I give for a Trinitarian doctrine of God and against Unitarian conceptions of God, such as you find in Islam, where you don't have a plurality of persons. I think that for God to be loving requires that there be another to whom God gives himself away. And since that can't be any created person, since created persons are contingent, there must be a plurality of persons within
the
divine being. But also the directedness of love. Love gives oneself away mm-hmm. to another. It just doesn't center narcissistically mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. oneself. Mm-hmm. And I think this makes it plausible to think that God is a plurality of persons, necessarily.
Okay. Well, then he's saying, but mere theism doesn't entail Christian theism, which in turn means it does not entail the Christian doctrine of the Trinity is true, and so it does not entail the existence of multiple divine persons.
Well, I think that depends on how you define theism. If you mean by theism simply the view that there is a creator and designer of the universe, I would agree.
That would be mere theism or generic theism.
Well, I don't know. It wouldn't imply the doctrine of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. But, as I say, if you say that love is an essential property of God, then I have argued that theism does entail not the doctrine of the Trinity, but at least a plurality of persons within God. That's my argument.
So even if it were the case that theism is necessarily true, it wouldn't follow that more than one person exists.
And that's why I disagree with
him. Back to the Trinity.
I've given an argument. Okay. For thinking that that is the case.
Okay. But if more than one person exists is a contingent proposition, this creates a problem for divine nature theorists like Craig, who want to argue that God's nature explains all objective moral values, including relational moral values like love and mercy.
And I would deny the antecedent of that sentence. I don't think that the sentence, more than one person exists, is a contingent proposition. That expresses a necessary proposition. And this is seen through the argument that I have given for a plurality of persons in the Godhead.
He says, sure, there's a sense in which we can talk about a person loving themselves or having mercy on themselves, but I think it's clear that that's not what people usually have in mind when they talk about love and mercy as moral values.
Amen. I want to say, Jeff, thou art not far from the kingdom of God. This is my argument against the Muslim and the Islamic conception of God. So I think he's on the right track.
So if moral values are properties of persons, if some moral values are relational, and if more than one person exists is a contingent proposition, then there are possible worlds in which God exists, but relational moral values do not exist.
And what would I deny, Kevin, in that statement?
That it's a contingent proposition.
Right. I think that it is not a contingent proposition that more than one person exists.
And he wraps it up saying, thus God's existence, even God's necessary existence, cannot explain necessary truths about all objective moral values, because it cannot explain necessary truths about relational moral values. But that entails Craig's moral argument fails.
And we've seen that that's based on this false reasoning. What doesn't get said here is what alternative Jeff wants to offer to theistic-based ethics. Is he going to defend atheistic moral Platonism? If so, then he owes us a response to the intelligibility objection that I raise against Platonism.
I want to say again that this shows the importance of your new book, God Overall, because it gives such a grounding for when you encounter articles like this that delve into these deep philosophical issues.
I must say, Kevin, it almost makes me laugh how time and time again I have chosen these abstruse, seemingly irrelevant topics like God and time or divine aseity as the focus of my research. And again and again and again, they prove to be relevant in unexpected ways in other areas.